weeks of coming close, the Dow Industrials have finally broken above that 20,000 level.
The market is dealing with this sort of whirlwind Trump rally.
I think the first week of the new administration, again, until policies are in place, it's a little hard to say this was a direct cause and effect, but there was a lot of news.
So what keeps this rally going and widens it is continuous signal that the Trump administration is moving on deregulation, on tax reform, and on infrastructure.
Economic growth in the United States slowed in the fourth quarter. GDP grew just 1.9%, down sharply from the 3.5% rate in the third quarter.
Holy cow! We didn't make the two handle 1.9.
But you have to remember, we've just gone through years where the central bank was basically throwing money at the economy, and you still did not get growth very far above 2%. I think Dow 20,000 is at least modestly important. I mean, again, I think it's like a milepost. It does not tell you, though, exactly how fast you're going down that highway and what's coming up ahead.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, it's been a very historic week for the markets this week, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average finally crossing 20,000 after lingering in a sideways correction for more than a month. This week, we were setting records in the market. That trend continues, even though we're having a slight pullback on this Friday. Markets are up this week. We got a weak GDP number, no more 2% plus. The GDP number was less than 2%. What's coming up ahead? Looks like stocks want to head higher. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Robin Griffith is with us, and he said the times, they are changing. And as Robin said, the train has left the station when it comes to the stock market. His four main indicators all changed with the election of Donald Trump. You're going to want to hear what he has to say about the markets going forward. Mark Chandler will also be here. He's a little bit cautious, but he thinks the dollar is going to head higher, and he thinks economic growth can pick up despite the fact interest rates will be going up as the Fed continues to raise rates going forward. Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler, and of course, the trend in which we are following right now is that you should expect the unexpected. Things are changing rapidly in the world, and they have here in the United States with a change of presidential administration. There is a clash of epic proportions coming, perhaps we should say, between President Trump and Fed Chair Janet Yellen, because they seem to be working at cross purposes to each other. Indeed, the president will be swimming uphill, going against headwinds when he tries to implement a lot of his policies, because we're at the tail end of a business cycle and the Fed is raising interest rates. What does all of this mean, especially in the area of investing? And we'll also have a special interview with Charles Gav of GavCal Research about his new book and concerns about what the future is holding as we expect the unexpected. All of that today on The Big Picture and the Financial Sense News Hour. And turning to the face of Ryan Poplava, should be bright. Dow hit 20,000 this week. It actually happened. You were here. You came. You saw. You were alive to see the day. You'll be telling this to your children and grandchildren.
Children.
Okay. Now, coming back to Earth, what does it mean for investors in the near term anyway?
Well, John, you know, anytime we hit some of these round levels, Dow 20,000, S&P 5,000, these are psychological levels, not unlike other psychological levels that have been passed before, Dow 10,000. If we dip below, you know, it could signal that some profit taking is taking place and could be a short-term sell signal. But much of the advance came about from traders who didn't want to be left out, given the market has been trading sideways for a month and now finally has broken to some new highs. So, you know, are we breaking out of this trading zone? Very possibly, you know, that alone can help us get some much needed momentum. But by the means of weak hands, that's an issue. So we got to make sure that this move is happening on good grounds, you know, good earnings, good economic growth. And the advance this week was based on some of that. And because we did have some good numbers that came out this week, good economic numbers, good earnings numbers. But yeah, I'd say some of it was also a little bit of chasing. So we're definitely seeing this week in the two main areas that I think the market is focused on are still driving this market, and that is growth and fiscal policy.
Okay, well, riding on that one then, what were some of the economic numbers? And there were earnings announcements this week that drove the growth side of the story.
Well, this week, a number of economic numbers hit that were good, including the Flash Purchasing Managers Index numbers. That's what we typically get to kind of rate and see how the economy, how manufacturing is doing, how services are doing, or rather just, manufacturing and goods. And that was in US, Europe, and Japan. China's no longer doing these flash numbers. They're only doing it at the end of the month. But all of those levels pointed towards some increase in growth there, which points towards global growth. Specifically, the US was up to, I think, 55.1 from, it was around 54.3 in December. So small growth, but anything above 50 is expansion. And we've been there for a while now. Another good number that tells the same story of this kind of global growth story was the increase in exports and imports for the US. And so we're getting both an increase in exports and imports. It's suggesting that we've got a good amount of activity going on. Initial claims bumped up this week, rather the last week. But, you know, the trend overall, John, has been one of a downward slope. So we're not too concerned about that. The market didn't hiccup or anything. And looking at the earnings component, we had, I think there was around 70 companies that announced this week. So I think if I talked about every individual one, we'd be here for a while. It'd be quite boring. But overall, one of the things I do is I look to see how many companies are beating. You know, are we above margin? Are we below margin? And the other thing too I look at is overall, do we have earnings growth? Remember, we had an earnings recession for many quarters and came out of that in the last quarter, third quarter 2016. So fourth quarter earnings, we're in the thick of that, reporting it right now. Earnings at the beginning of the season were estimated to be growing at 2.6%, according to FactSet. Those expectations have climbed during the earnings season as actual results are coming out, up towards 3.4% growth. So that's great. That alone, John, if we just have great economic results, which we had before the elections, and if we have earnings growth, that's the medicine for, you know, a higher market. As long as nothing hurts the PE and the sentiment of what people feel justify high valuations or ultra high valuations or cheap valuations, you know, that's all based on sentiment, how people feel about the economy. And those measurements have been very positive. We've seen the business COOs, small business expectations and surveys, and those have been very good over the last couple of months. So if we just have those things, if we have growth, that could do it all. But there's also, you know, fiscal policy as well, which Trump has no doubt added to the equation.
Yeah, it is sort of interesting, isn't it? And by the way, that turns us to the other side of the growth coin, given all the press conferences and flash photography sessions with Trump this week. He met with Prime Minister Theresa May from Great Britain. But what's actually getting done? I mean, it seems like things are moving at a pretty good clip, and he's really pounding on things to keep it moving forward. And what is, as you say, moving the needle on the fiscal stimulus speedometer for investors?
Well, for right now, it is a lot of flash. You know, the press conferences, the Republicans held a meeting to discuss their agenda. But there is some meat there. As you said, Trump had a number of meetings with the press involved, including meetings this week with, as you said, Prime Minister May of the UK to discuss trade, tax cuts, and Trump's goals to make America great again. So in Congress, like I said, the Republicans met in Philadelphia to discuss their plans, and Speaker Ryan rolled out a 200-day agenda to essentially, obviously, cut taxes. But, you know, what I found interesting, John, was that there was no focus on infrastructure spending. That's one of those three pillars of what have really moved the market higher on fiscal policy. That's been stimulus, infrastructure spending, and deregulation. But yeah, no infrastructure spending on that discussion, but the market didn't hiccup too much on any of that. Believes that, you know, obviously Trump has a lot of political currency with investors right now, with the expectation that we'll see some fruit in those areas. But, you know, one thing I thought that was interesting this week was some comments from Representative Kevin Brady. Kevin Brady is the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, and he said a couple of times this week, he emphasized it on, I think, Wednesday and also on Tuesday, the importance that any budget reform be neutral, meaning that it doesn't widen the deficit any more than an already ongoing operations continue to do. So he said it would be very difficult to bring down corporate taxes meaningfully without adding, he mentioned, a border adjustment tax or border adjustment taxes just in general. And obviously we know from Trump, he's really drumming up that beat, right? He's talking about not necessarily free trade, which has been hammered on the public for decades, but you know, he's doing something different. He's saying, let's have fair trade. I heard it in one of his press conferences, and that kind of really hits home that we did so many things that maybe not necessarily were in the best interest of the U.S., or maybe for corporations, not the U.S., and obviously clearly his constituent, which is the middle class manufacturing American that has seen jobs move offshore. But anyways, his comments were especially emphasized because a report, and this is regarding Kevin Brady and his discussion about the debt. There was a report from CBO concerning a forecast to our debt over the, I think, the next 10 years, I think, that shows they anticipate an expansion of debt. Obviously, we're going to continue to do that if we spend more than we earn, held by the public from what is already at elevated levels. And those levels are close to levels we have seen for percent of GDP since World War II. They haven't been higher. And that hits home to me in the long term that while, you know, Trump has been on this political campaign and trail that there's been a lot of promises, well, now he's in the office and now it comes down to, can these things actually get done with debt our size? Yes, we can lower corporate taxes, but there's going to have to be some movement somewhere else, some give and take, obviously. And that could easily limit what he promises and what he can actually do.
Okay, would you say that the new high in the Dow Industrials actually breaks us free from all of the sideways trading we've been in for, what, about a month now, something like that, digesting the post-election rally, something like that?
Technically speaking, from a technical standpoint, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closing above 20,000 in that psychological level, it is a new high. It has done it. But for most technicians, whenever these occurrences happen, if it's 20,000 like a psychological level, or let's say we never got above 19,920, let's say that was the high, you got to break out above these levels by 1-3% to be really sure that in the near term, that it was a good breakout, that it does have some, possibly some legs to it. And the reason for that is you tend to get whipsaws in the markets. We see these psychological levels. Everybody sees it. It's printed on the wall. The expectation is that we're mostly in a bull market. We're probably going to break through it. So we break through it. And then, okay, now what? If it breaks back below that level, we call that a whipsaw. And you want to prevent yourself from being influenced by such moves. So it has broken out to new highs. We have technically parted from the sideways trading near term, but it's got to stay above that 20,000 level. Dips below that, that's a concern.
Well, next week, the Fed will meet, and obviously we'll get some important economic data, which could continue to support the rally to new highs or muzzle it, mute it down if growth concerns arise from any of these data points. So what are you anticipating coming along next week with all of these events just coming over the horizon?
The important numbers to watch will be three inflation data points. I think we'll get two of them ahead of the Fed meeting. And that's the PCE on Monday, the ECI on Tuesday. And then towards the end of the week, we'll get wages from the jobs report. So those three areas really focus on wages. And wages are a very large component of inflation. So obviously the Fed will likely be able to see those two numbers before they announce on Wednesday. I doubt it will change their plans and strategy. We're looking at a few rate hikes as estimated at the December meeting. So with a jump in rates just on the heels of a December, I think expectations are that we won't get a raise here, but possibly at the March meeting. But it should be a big week for economics. We're also in the heart of the earnings season. I haven't heard anything too concerning so far in all these conference calls that I'm listening in on some of our companies. Most CEOs seem pretty upbeat, the COOs as well. on the economy, and the numbers so far jive with that feeling, you know, based on the economic results. GDP number disappointed a little bit this week, but I've seen other expectations by other analysts that through the rest of the quarter, as we get more revisions to that estimate, that it could be going up based on, I think, inventory numbers. We got durable goods, we got, which you factor out transports, was actually really good. You have to remember sometimes, even though our stock market is mature and valuations are elevated right now at, I think, 17 times earnings for the S&P 500, that doesn't reflect the rest of the world, which was in a recession for far longer than we were. And so we're not the only market out there. Beyond the U.S., there's also world markets. And eventually, sometimes the U.S. at certain points takes its tone in the market based on what's going on overseas. And so far, what we see over there, economic activity continues to also improve there. And lately in Japan, we've seen some really great trade numbers for them. So overall, things are still looking good. No trouble on the near-term horizon. However, like I said, all that fiscal currency that Trump has, you know, there's a very large gap between, I think, reality and where that currency is currently placing him. And we could very well see that gap narrow through the rest of the quarters. What will that do to the markets? I don't think it's going to create a bear market. But, you know, the PE ratio, that's a sentiment indicator. It's based on how people feel. And if we start to feel that a little disappointed in Trump, well, it's going to take some of the icing on the cake that we may be feeling right now.
Jim says we are living in times where we should expect the unexpected. Of course, I usually follow that up with a question like, well, what should we expect from expecting the unexpected, you know, in terms of some stability? But they are going to be interesting times. You know, the new rules are still being forged here, meaning what everybody assumes to be the status quo. And I think that that remains to be seen, which will keep things interesting for a while. Not to mention what Jim and I are going to talk about today in the big picture is a brewing war between Janet Yellen and Donald Trump.
Yeah, and I believe he's going to announce who he thinks should be a part of the Fed next week as well. There should be some discussion about that. So, yeah, it'll be interesting.
Yeah, should be interesting. Anyway, Ryan Poplava, really appreciate it. Look forward to next week.
No problem. We'll talk to you then.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at FinancialSense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
At over a billion people and almost 20% of the world's total population, China has experienced one of the most rapid economic transformations in all of human history. Joining us on the show today is Jacob Shapiro. He's the Director of Analysis at Geopolitical Futures. And Jacob, before we get right into China and some of the implications of Trump now being elected and what's going to take place there, would you mind giving our audience a bit of background on the framework you use at Geopolitical Futures for understanding the geopolitical space, how you distinguish between things that are important for predicting what might take place and what's not important?
I would start by saying that Geopolitical Futures is the brainchild of George Friedman. So if anyone is familiar with George's work before, you'll be familiar with this methodology. But really what it all starts with is, well, it all starts with geopolitics. And geopolitics for us is not just a synonym for international relations, although that is often how it is used by many people, especially in the media, become kind of a fad word. For us, it's a methodology and it's a technique. It's about understanding the intersection between geography and power. Geography is sort of self-explanatory. Think of it in terms of the things that can't change, where a mountain is, where a river is, what that means for a country's economy, for its defense. And power really has, you know, only three real manifestations. We can talk about economic power, military power, maybe diplomatic power, although that's less important for us. And when you lay all these things out and you start thinking about geopolitics, you begin to see that history makes some sense and that you can try and see what's going to happen going forward, because most countries and therefore most political leaders have a limited amount of choices at their disposal. They may want to do a lot of different things. China's a great example of a communist country by ideology, sort of working in a quasi-capitalist economy right now because that's what they need to do. So we build a model based on geopolitics. That model is a forecast going forward. We have a forecast for 2017 or for whatever year is in front of us. We have a 20-year forecast and then a 40-year forecast.
Well, it's been another historic week for the markets. Finally, after going sideways for a month, the Dow Jones Industrial Average finally crossed that magic number of 20,000. Are better days ahead or changes ahead of us? Joining us on the program is Robin Griffiths. And Robin, let's talk about your latest newsletter, Times They Are Changing. Certainly they are. Your prime minister is meeting with our president today.
Yes, and the quote from the Bob Dylan song begins, "Come mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand," because Mr. Market had not anticipated two very big events late last year. Over here it was Brexit, and in the USA it was Mr. Trump becoming president. These two events were not anticipated by the market, and therefore were not in any way discounted ahead of time. As it turns out, the Brexit event, although big for Britain, could be put into the category of a little local difficulty. It turns out that Europe has got problems of its own, compared to which whether Britain is actually in or out is nothing more than a thorn in the side, a big thorn, but that's all. Whereas no major world trends changed on the Brexit vote. But within days of Donald Trump winning, and well before he was inaugurated, four major chart trends on my work altered completely. It was a complete game changer. And when every major index in the USA makes a pattern of rising highs and lows above rising moving averages and makes new all-time high breakouts, doesn't matter what you'd been saying before that, it's going up, and just admit it, basically. Don't have to understand it, just accept it's going up. In my work, we look at three things, what you might call the fundamentals, the growth prospects. Secondly, the valuation basis. And finally, what's it doing on the chart, going up, down, or sideways? And these three things don't always work together. Sometimes they fight each other. And we have a sort of composite weighted thing to show overall. And when on balance they're going down, you're in a bear market. And indeed, all world markets have been in a bear market for basically 15 months now, and that included the USA. But on the Donald's winning, that's changed. The USA is now says it's back in a bull market. The fact that it's, you know, already had one of the longest runs ever in history, just it's going up, basically, at least in the short term. I think what's happening is the market is taking it as a given without knowing. It's just on trust. He's going to make us great again. He's going to cut taxes, do some shovel-ready projects that will employ real Americans working here in America and make our infrastructure nicer than it's been, because it's been pretty rusty, some of those bridges. He's going to make car factories come back here for us, and he's going to tax imports, so it'll be better to buy homegrown stuff, basically. The dollar will be strong, interest rates will be picking up, and as infrastructure projects use stuff, plenty of commodities, especially industrial metals, are now quite clearly trending upwards. And that's a given. Secondly, most new presidents get a honeymoon period, especially when that coincides with what is normally the seasonal strong part of the year. And you know the old thing, you go up and you sell in May. One final thing on pure technical timing. Markets hardly ever go more than 300 days without at least a 10% correction. And we're on just over 250 now. So one way or another, he's got at least a 2-month, 3-month honeymoon sort of thing. And then it might start to run into problems. But the main problem isn't that the economy is going to go pear-shaped or even that anything will go wrong with the earnings of the companies. The big problem in my work is the valuation basis. All U.S. indices, however we dress it up, are more expensive than they've been practically ever in history. And we know if you buy them on this sort of valuation basis, it's pretty difficult to make much of a positive return. And at some stage, you risk a pretty big negative. So it looks to me as, at the moment, the momentum behind the pro-Donald move, he's hit the ground running, let's face it. And it's a freight train coming down the track at top speed. If you don't want to be on board it, at least get out of its way. but it'd be dumb to do anything else. But the train will not keep running forever because a very strong dollar, a very rising interest rates, and rising commodity prices are all things that negatively squash the growth prospects down the road a bit. And secondly, some of the growth that America will achieve by becoming great again will be at the expense of other countries elsewhere in the world. That's the whole point about Mr. Trump's agenda. And yet we're all living in a joined up world. And the stronger the dollar gets, you're effectively forcing devaluations on some other countries. And finally, and this is the biggie here, the higher interest rates go, and as they're coming off such a low level, they don't need to get very high. I mean, 3%, 3.2% might do it. The wealth destruction in plenty of global bond markets will be so big, somewhere around the world, there's going to be a credit crunch. Somebody's going to go bust, pear-shaped. Now, I don't know whether it's Greece or some other Turkey. I mean, we could come up with a lot of nations that are struggling already and it's going to get tougher. Or it may be somewhere in Malaysia. We don't know. At least I don't know. I know enough to know that I don't know. But the probability is very, very high. There will be a credit crunch somewhere in the world before our interest rates and inflation actually gets very far up the scale. And so we've got to get through that before we then go back to now we're growing again type of thing. So I think in the short term, especially with America, you've got to be at least a trading bull for now, seeing the risks growing. And the big risk is valuation basis and debt mountain. After all, Trump's going to have to borrow, is it $1 trillion? You know, eventually this becomes a problem. And when we then look elsewhere, they're already struggling with their debt mountain. So there's one easy way of looking at it, which I do in my newsletter. If you look at the world index, I use the FT World Index, and you simply strip out the USA from that, of course, it's the biggest single constituent. It is perfectly clear that the rest of the world is well into a bear market, and it's having a rally in a bear market, but it is nowhere near going into a new bull market. It's only the USA, which on the back of Mr. Trump, has moved into this aggressive risk-on, we want small, high-volatile equities, we want bang for our buck, we're going for growth, and we don't much care about collecting dividends. Within all the other markets, they want to be much more cautious. The equities that they own are big market cap, so you can sell them when you want to, and they better be paying jolly good dividends, and that dividend stream would better look a lot better than owning a government bond.
I want to talk about two issues, because you said right now the train has left the station. You certainly don't want to get in front of it. In fact, one gentleman that got in front of it was George Soros, and he lost $1 billion betting against the new president. So there's a lesson to be learned there. But two issues I want to talk about. Right now, the train is traveling at a fast pace, and markets are doing well, especially here in the U.S. But you mentioned two issues that I think that could be a problem. Number one is market valuations are the highest that I've seen. You'd have to go back to 2000 or 1929 to see valuations at this level. So that's a problem, number one. Problem number two, the Fed has said they're going to raise interest rates and keep raising interest rates over the next 2 years. At some point, Robin, that's going to cause an issue because there's $9 trillion of dollar-denominated loans. Somebody's going to have a major problem, as you point out.
Well, what my work says is I use the 10-year Treasury as a good benchmark. On its own chart, with fluctuations, the yield won't just rise straight away. There will be times, short-term periods, when on a pullback, it looks like bonds are an okay buy again. But it looks as though the yield on that can get to 3%, just possibly 3.2% this year sometime. And the Fed will almost certainly track Mr. Market's rise all of the way with however many hikes it takes to do that. But once you start getting past that, you hit major resistance. And I think this rise in rate is what will actually force the credit crunch in some weaker country that I can't put a finger on exactly. But the probability that it will do that is very high. And that's what will bring us to the end of the honeymoon period and at least a correction. And because the valuation basis is, as you've said, so extraordinarily high, even if the major indices fell 50%, they would not bring the rating down to as cheap as it often gets. It would bring it down to approximately fair value by its own historic yardsticks. Now, I find that a problem. Now, we've seen earlier on, if you remember some part of last year, the stocks were called FANG and NOSH. And we watched, for example, on Apple, the price-earnings ratio once got up to over 800, and then it fell back to 300. But these are still what you might call nosebleed territory numbers. We can't have the S&P up on 27 times earnings for long. It's just not really doable. He hasn't even cut the taxes yet and done the shovel-ready projects. I think it would be extraordinarily dumb to get in the way of this move that's taking place now. But the second thing, which is absolutely on the side of the bullish view, is on the economic numbers that I look at of 36 major world markets, none of them are saying we're going to get a recession this year. We might be, by normal cycle terms, we're kind of due. We've already had too long a rise up. But on the numbers we're looking at, the world economies do not look like they're going to have a recession this year. The last quarter, the U.S. figure came out at growth of 1.9%, which was a little lower than people had expected. But that was for a period before Mr. Trump got to the White House. He's now going for about 4%. And even I think Janet Yellen is thinking, well, maybe 2.5%. That would be good for something this big. That's a lot of growth. Over there in Asia, the Chinese economy really is growing fairly steadily at about 6.5%. And most people expect, yeah, but it will slow down. It can't keep that up because it's been done on borrowed money. So how about we look down the road for something like 4%? That's still an awful lot of growth for something that big. And nowhere near a recession here in England, you know, notwithstanding the gloom that our own Bank of England man told us ahead of the Brexit vote, we're doing about 2%, one of the better, in fact, the best in this part of the world of economic performance. So there is no good reason that I can see to expect a depression or recessionary scenario this year. If we're going to move into one of them, it's sometime later, 2018 to 19. But what we can have this year is the valuation basis falls back more into line. And you don't need anything to go wrong with the economy or the stocks. It's just the market comes down. At the moment, as people take money out of government bonds, because with interest rates rising, you're going to lose capital value there, they've got no choice but to buy some equities. And I think quite a lot of U.S. citizens are actually saying, well, I'm a bull, but I don't want to buy bad value. Let me look at some of these overseas markets, see if I can't find a world-class stock which is cheaper than our own one. And quite a lot of money is flowing like that. So it's on the bull story, but trying to be a little bit picky with value. Or alternatively, it's specifically in the US, people are going for smaller market cap stocks, where if you get it right, you get a lot more bang for your buck. That's very specifically more willingness to go risk on in the USA than we're seeing in other markets. It stands out to me, basically.
Robert, I want to bring up something rather interesting. Doing a little research on presidential cycles, President Trump is the first president that will not enter office and see a recession in his first year of office. If you take a look at the two recent presidents, Bush and Obama entered office with a recession with the Federal Reserve lowering interest rates. Trump is entering office with an aging business cycle and the Fed raising interest rates. It was interesting because an article in the Wall Street Journal came out this week and said that Trump will either preside over the longest economic recovery in history or face a recession.
The way I could imagine a recession coming is that it's triggered from outside of the USA by a credit crunch that the U.S. can handle, but these other countries can't. Now, in some of the countries, it may be that they lose a trade negotiation battle with Mr. Trump. And that's the final crunch that makes their economy go down. And then you renege on some debts. That would be the sort of scenario. But the U.S. economy is coming from a position of strength. And within Europe, Britain is actually negotiating from a position of strength. We are a contributor to Europe, not a taker from it. So it's the weakest link in a chain that breaks, isn't it, always? So I don't think the actual break will come from either Britain or USA, but it will knock on to us. And when the valuation is up where it is, I mean, remember 1987? We seem to be in the middle of a roaring bull market. You blink twice and we're down 25% before anyone knows what's happened. That sort of flash crash type of thing, I think we're vulnerable to. For years, I've used cycle work I think the shorter term cycles, the 4-year kitchen wave has been overridden by QE and that sort of thing. But if you look at the 10-year cycle, the 7th year in any decade is very frequently the one with either a top in it or frequently a nasty, short, sharp setback in it. Of course, if you push yourself to the very summit of the mountain first, there's only one way to go after that, isn't there? At least for a while. I think Mr. Trump is not like any previous president. And after all, he'd had 3 major car companies say, all right, we'll build our next factory in the USA before he was even inaugurated. So he's already delivering on things just on the back of a few tweets before even being president. So I'm sure he's a kick-ass kind of a guy who's going to get stuff done. And pretending that he won't just because you don't like him, maybe, is not the way to go. Mr. Market has decided, we like this guy, he's good for us. And, you know, I'm a student of what Mr. Market believes, and I believe it, basically. You don't get the fastest ever 1,000-point rise in the Dow without some story behind it, do you? I particularly feel on the industrial metal stage that those stocks were beaten up for 4 or 5 years, and they were genuinely cheap. And it's not only America doing infrastructure. China's building this new Silk Road, which makes the Great Wall of China look like a weekend project. It's huge. This will be using a lot of copper, a lot of steel, a lot of aluminium, a lot of fiber optics. This is going to drive commodity prices. So I think, especially in the industrial metal space, the commodity cycle, the bear market, which was 5 years long, has turned already. The only area of slight doubt is in the precious metals, particularly in gold. The gold on my work is at the moment relatively weak. As soon as it comes under $1,200, that's my stop loss level. It doesn't mean it's a sell, but it definitely means it, you know, I'm not allowed to buy it. So I need it back above $1,200 before I can say, now the gold's resuming its run.
So as you look at this, as you say, you're a student of the markets, and the markets seem to be enjoying Mr. Trump. Certainly, he is different than any other president. First of all, he's not a politician, and he's probably gotten more accomplished, not even being president as president-elect, than anyone before him. Is it possible, then, that the Wall Street Journal may be right? He could, potentially, preside over the longest economic recovery in U.S. history.
Certainly the last part of it, because it's already been running for a long time, breaking quite a lot of earlier records. That is entirely possible. The only bit, and I don't want to sound like Cassandra, but if you say to me, well, what could go wrong? I mean, we're talking about a lot that can go right. What can go wrong is the debt mountain. And even America's got a debt mountain, and he's going to borrow an extra $1 trillion over 4 years, isn't he, to do some of his projects. That is a problem. And as interest rates come up from very low levels, even moving from 1 to 2, somebody has had half their capital wiped out on that move. And from 2 to 4, somebody else has another half their capital wiped out. So that can't go on very far before something very nasty comes our way down the pike, basically. If you took a 30-year view, we could get back to Reagan and Mrs. Thatcher days with interest rates way up and inflation way up. But that's the long, long way down the road. And in the current world, interest rates, I don't think, can rise much past 3% without forcing a nasty problem on the debt mountain, which would give us a temporarily more deflationary pressure to get through. Now, in my work, I've already made the call that the 35-year bond bull market, which I normally call Bill Gross's bull market, in the U.S., it's over. That is to say, when interest rates come down again, I do not think they will go lower than they were at the low last year. They can go back towards that low, but won't break it. It's not yet, to be honest, unequivocally clear that that is the case on the chart. There's a jolly good chance that that is the case. But if when the credit crunch comes, it's a bad one, rather than an average one, then I might be wrong again. And I think some back in 2003, I tried to make this call before, so did Bill Gross. And we looked pretty good for over a year, but we were ultimately wrong. So the same might happen to us. But at the moment, I think just using the US 10-year Treasury, Mr. Market moved the yields up 100 basis points before the Fed did anything. I can't have a move like that on my charts without me saying, you know what? The trend's changed. That's how it is with me, basically. So I actually think that the great bond bull market is over, and you can have pullbacks within it. But basically, the long-term trend for interest rates now is upwards. but it'll have to be very slow and steady to begin with because of the losses that it will be occurring around the world.
You bring up an interesting point, because if you look at individual investors, since 2009, a vast majority of their money has gone into the bond market. And even though the bond market did not go up as much as the stock market did, individual investors still were making a decent return. They were getting their income, and the bond values held. Now, when you talk about what happened from last summer, when we hit the lows of 1.3 to almost 2.6 by the end of the year, and if we go towards 3, what happens to individual investors when they start seeing their safe investments in bond funds? They can actually lose money.
They can, and they have to sell it and go back into the cult of the equity. Unfortunately, the equities they love best are expensive. So I think it may well make the average private U.S. investor more international in his outlook than he's previously been, because to get value, he needs to do that. And again, in my work, on that basis, you want to buy something high quality where it's not outrageously expensive and you can see growth. And the two big countries are China and India. They're both going to grow to be enormous economies. China is several decades ahead of India, but they're both getting there. One's growing at 6.5% per annum. India's more like 8% per annum at the moment. And actually, because Mr. Modi is doing the good thing of trying to get rid of corruption, he's produced a policy which is causing a short-term setback in the Indian market. He's demonetized 500,000 rupee notes, because those are the ones that the bribes are always paid in. So by getting rid of them, he's caused a short, sharp setback in the market. To me, that's a slam-dunk buying opportunity. I don't think the Sensex index is going to drop below 25,000, and any low near there is a good chance to add to the holding or buy one if you haven't got one already, and then just sit back and watch India compound its growth at something close to 10% per annum for a decade, because it's coming off such a low base. It doesn't have to invent anything. It just has to use some of our technology to get going. And it's a typical catch-up. For example, in banking, Britain and America, we had to go through the whole thing growing from little piggy banks and to the whole banking history. In India, they're not doing that. Millions of people in the villages don't have a bank account, but they've all got a mobile phone, and they're going straight to doing banking on their mobile phone. In the last 12 months, almost 200 million new such accounts have been opened up. They don't need pieces of plastic. They don't need all the paper accounts and all the checkbooks that we've all gone through. They're just going straight in with the, I'm doing it on my mobile phone. So their catch-up growth is going to be very rapid indeed. And of course, they've got great demographics.
So if we were summing up, Robin, you say right now the train has left the station. You certainly don't want to get in front of it and short it, or you could end up like George Soros. So would you stay on board the train if you're there, but at some point you're going to have to get off?
I think that's correct. So if you're a genuine long-term investor, the way someone like Mr. Buffett is, you don't sell your favorite holdings. You just accept for a while, look, the price is ridiculous, it'll come back a bit. But after that, it'll grow back up to my level again. If you've got the ability psychologically to live through those fluctuations, then if you've got great companies, just hold them. But I personally think that the likely setback in the second half of the year would be big enough for many people to say, you know what, I'll just take the top off some of these holdings, and then I'll put the money back in again on a dip. I'll only have to wait for, let's say, 6 months. And incidentally, if you're going to hold cash, holding it in US dollars is not going to be a bad thing. You don't want to hold your cash in euros or sterling. You want to hold it in dollars. I mean, if the average British investor last year had liquidated his entire portfolio, put it into US dollars and just sat there, he'd have been a lot better off than he is today. That's even with FTSE at a new all-time high. But I would certainly, as a U.S. citizen, be looking to increase the international exposure in my portfolio. The two big areas would be China, or China-related investment, not actually in China, China-related and Indian investments. And you could use things like ETFs to do that. With specific sectors, I would very much favor metals and mining, industrial metals and mining. And, you know, you don't have to go very far above your border. The Canadian stocks are looking quite good. I think you'll need to know more about it than me, about exactly what sort of tariff barrier might Mr. Trump do I think he'll be a lot nicer to the Canadians than he's going to be to Mexicans. But, you know, technically, there might be some tariff barrier to consider there that I simply don't know about yet. Maybe nobody knows about it yet. But those would be the only sort of issues. But metals and mining stocks, especially in copper, nickel, cobalt, these sorts of things, I would have big holdings in them. On gold, I like the look of the gold mining shares rather better than I like the look of the metal itself, actually.
So right now, the train's left the station. If you're on board, enjoy the ride. If you own good quality stocks and can stomach a correction, hold on to them. Robin, if people would like to follow your work, how could they do so?
Well, there are two websites. One is called globalinvestmentroadmap.com, and it links to another one called the ECU, Echo Charlie Universe Group.com. They both link up together. And when on the Global Investment Roadmap website, if people want to talk to a person, there's a lady called Jessica Scott, and she'd be very happy to respond and tell people what of my output would be available to them. My really big document is designed for large asset management companies. It's not really aimed at private individuals, but we do have briefer products which have been written as though the reader is a high net worth individual rather than an institutional fund manager. And Jessica can point them in the right direction.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
If you've been listening to the show for the past month and a half, you'll know that we've been discussing this major development where India, the world's second most populous nation, has taken a big step forward towards a cashless society when Prime Minister Modi abolished about 80% or more of all of rupee banknotes in circulation. And the end goal, as he said, is towards a full cashless society. This is just the first step, a pretty big first step, we should say. However, there's more to this story than just what's happening in India, and there's some other players involved. And so today we're going to have on Norbert Haring. He's a writer for Germany's leading business newspaper, the Handelsblatt. He's the co-founder of the World Economics Association. He's also the author of The Abolition of Cash and the Consequences, which is currently published in German. Also, he's a regular economics blogger at Norbert Haring, that's his name.de, if you want to read up on his work there. Norbert, thanks for coming onto the show. I want to ask you about some of the background as you see it in terms of the players and some of the key organizations at work in terms of getting this demonetization initiative launched in India. Do you mind telling us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. It didn't come out of the blue like it did for the Indian people. It was prepared, and it was prepared with foreign help. There was a partnership of the finance ministry in India, the U.S. aid, the American Development Agency, and that partnership also included a bunch of other organizations like Visa, MasterCard, companies that have a direct interest in digitalizing money and doing away with cash. And once you know what happened and you read back on this partnership, you find a lot of reports by the likes of McKinsey or Boston Consulting Group together with Google that actually prepared that. They didn't say what they prepared. Some of these reports were talking about a trial in a certain city, and they were talking about finding the right city, and that they wanted to really scale up digital payments in that city with some stark measures. So in retrospect, it looks like some sort of cover operations, but they were really talking about it, and they could research it all in the open without letting it be known that they really wanted to demonetize cash in the whole of India. It was well prepared. And Washington, let's say the U.S. government and New York Wall Street organizations had a big hand on it. One of the partners, actually, of that partnership of USAID and Indian Finance Ministry is a group called the Better Than Cash Alliance. And that's a group that has been formed in 2012 already and includes many of the same U.S. players. And they're openly working for doing away with cash. So they were involved in that preparation, and India did exactly what they are striving for.
Well, the markets are up this year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, finally, after struggling for a month, is over 20,000. The dollar has been going up. Interest rates have also been rising. So what does all of this mean for the markets? Joining us on the program is Mark Chandler from Brown Brothers Harriman. Mark, let's talk about the dollar, because the dollar has been on a rise, and we have some implications in the news this week about a possible trade spat between the United States, the new president, and Mexico. What does all this mean for the dollar? And more importantly, what is this going to mean for the U.S. economy? Everything from, let's say, aircraft companies to car companies.
I've sort of been tracking the dollar index, and I sort of have it trending down since the day after the Federal Reserve hiked interest rates on December 14th. And what I've been telling our clients at Brown Brothers is that the dollar's correction, that downside correction, is almost over. It's beginning to lose some momentum, and I think they were seeing, despite the softer GDP number we had, the general undertone of the U.S. economy seems strong enough to allow people to have confidence the Federal Reserve is likely to raise interest rates two or three times this year. The market is pricing in about a 1 in 4 or a 1 in 3 chance of a hike in March. Stronger dollar has far-reaching implications, of course. I don't think the Federal Reserve is so concerned about the level of the dollar as the pace it's moving. And so far here in January, the pace is not very troubling. They're really consolidating those strong gains we had from last year. But where this is going to impact the stock market in particular, I think people are going to be concerned as companies report earnings. They might see a hit on their earnings, especially those companies that have large foreign sales. And that would include the technology companies and the pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, because I've seen, even in fourth quarter earnings, some companies said they missed their estimates because of dollar translation. So if you take a look at the S&P 500 companies and you take a look at the Dow companies, most of these companies are international companies. They sell overseas. You take a company like Coca-Cola, they get almost 60% of its sales overseas. If the dollar goes up, that is going to hurt earnings. So I find it interesting that we have estimates for higher stock prices, higher earnings, and I could see that coming from the energy sector, maybe the financial sector, which would help S&P earnings. But what about the other groups that get a large portion of their sales overseas? If the dollar goes up, wouldn't that hurt earnings?
A lot of people recognize that this is exactly what you called it. I think it's a proper name, translation, because what happens is, say, a company like Apple. So they sell their goods overseas, and they translate those earnings, they translate them back into dollars. So those foreign earnings translate into fewer dollars. But what do? They keep that money offshore anyways. And so this is more of an accounting function than a real economic function. I think a lot of investors try to look past that, and there might be some other factors that might offset the impact of the dollar. For example, the new administration is talking about tax cuts. They are talking about deregulation. We're likely to see a more friendly environment for mergers and acquisitions. And so these kinds of activities, I think, is what's helping drive the equity market higher.
So let's say, for example, I have a company and I make $100 million. I'm in a 35% tax bracket. So on $100 million worth of profit, I pay the government $35 million out of my $100 million because of my tax rate. If Trump brings down tax rates to 15% or 20%, depending on what gets passed, ultimately, instead of paying $35 million in taxes on that $100 million, I could pay $20 million or $15 million. That's a big boost to my bottom line.
You show me a large S&P 500 company paying 35% taxes, and I'll show you a company that's not spending enough on lawyers. That is to say, that's to say that the effective tax rate of U.S. corporates is not the tax schedule. And that's what politicians often talk about. That's what companies often complain about. But when you really look at the effective tax rate, and the OECD does this, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development looks at the effective tax rate. And I believe the effective tax rate is closer to 20 or 25% in the U.S. So what Trump is talking about, the new administration is talking about, yes, you cut the corporate tax rate, but you close loopholes. So I think that the biggest benefit from corporations might come from the administration's promise to not only freeze regulation, which is typical of a new administration. Obama did that. Reagan did that. The common practice, because you don't know what the old guy, your predecessor, has got in the pipeline. So you freeze all regulation. But where Trump has gone one step further is he says, for every new regulation that he introduces, he'll get rid of two old ones. And so I think that we should be anticipating, I think this is partly what investors are anticipating, businesses are anticipating, is a lighter regulatory environment, for good or for bad.
So as we look at this, and here's one question I'd like to pose to you. Let's suppose that the president gets his goals passed, he lowers taxes, he reduces regulation, and the economy picks up. The economic growth picks up along with it earnings, but we get a little bit more inflation. The Fed gets a little bit more aggressive because if you take a look at the dot plots, Mark, they anticipate that they're not only going to just raise interest rates this year, they anticipate raising interest rates next year. At what point does the Fed's ability or goals of raising interest rates and normalizing monetary policy come into conflict with the goals of the new administration to create more jobs and make the economy grow?
You're right. There's a lot of moving parts here. And I would see it something like this, that the administration, if they do this trillion-dollar infrastructure, the deregulation, and juice up the U.S. economy's growth towards the levels that I think Trump talked about during the campaign for a while, 5 to 6%, this is going to be inflationary. There's going to be a lot of bottlenecks. And so the Federal Reserve slowly, gradually is raising interest rates. I think this might help extend that, but what we want to really focus on, I think, is the real rate of real interest rates. And right now we're sitting with, say, for the sake of an argument, say it's 2% CPI. That puts our 10-year bond yield at about real yield at about 50 basis points, still very stimulative. And so I'm not sure. I think that I'd point out two things. One is the Federal Reserve has other tools besides raising interest rates. One of the things that some of the Trump's advisors want to do, and several of the regional Federal Reserve presidents have talked about, is that now that the normalization process is underway, we should begin thinking about shrinking the Fed's balance sheet. There is something like $250 billion of treasuries that mature this year and about twice as many next year. And so what the Federal Reserve could do is instead of recycling, when a bond matures, they just replace it now, keep their balance sheet roughly the same size. They could slowly reduce the balance sheet, which is another way of normalizing monetary conditions without raising interest rates. But I'm not sure that we're at the point yet where we could say that a certain rate of interest is too high and that's going to choke off the economy. During the campaign, Trump was critical of the Federal Reserve for keeping rates low because he said this was a trick to help re-elect Democrats or help elect Hillary Clinton, which of course doesn't look like it worked very well. But so now to switch gears and to say now we want to keep rates low, which seemed to be also very difficult. I think the Federal Reserve's independence will be protected. I think that Yellen stays on this year, Fisher stays on, they complete their term, and continue this gradual normalization of monetary policy, slow enough to allow the economy to still expand, but quick enough to make sure investors know that they're not going to let inflation get out of hand.
So when you take a look at some of the estimates I've seen for this year, they're looking at 10-year Treasury yields maybe 3% by the end of the year. Certainly from a historical perspective, when we've seen the Fed funds rate in 10-year at 4 and 5%, and when you start getting up to 4 and 5%, that's when you might run into real trouble for the economy. And obviously at 2.5, we're a long ways from that point.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know exactly 4 or 5%, but I think that there's some sectors that are very sensitive to interest rates. The interesting thing I think now is that many American homeowners have refinanced and have locked in lower interest rates. Interest rates are important for the auto sector too. I mean, you think about it, we had record auto sales. A lot of this is on auto loans. And those loans might be sensitive, so instead of having 0% financing like many car dealers offer, maybe you're having to pay a low interest rate, or maybe you get better incentives to offset the higher interest rates. So So I think that we have to accept the fact that when there's a greater demand for capital for investment purposes, as businesses expand, as the government expands, whether it's infrastructure, what have you, that this greater demand of capital raises the real cost of capital. And the interest rates help to allocate it. And so as interest rates go up, think about other booming times in the U.S. economy where we get that sustained growth above 3%. You know, Obama is the first president in recent times that did not get a single year of growth above 3%. So if Trump is able to succeed in doing that, we should expect higher interest rates to help allocate that scarce resource.
So as you look at this, let's suppose that the president does get through his policies. He gets rid of regulation, which a lot of businesses have been complaining. He lowers the corporate tax rate. And then he also goes to corporations and say, look, you've got $2.5 trillion of profits overseas. You bring them home, you invest it. We're going to give you a one-time special tax rate of 10%. So that money comes here. So if you look at all these stimulative effects, you believe, given where interest rates are now, we still have room to grow this economy at a faster rate before rates get high enough to be harmful.
Yeah, I think so. But I think you're right that this is sort of the healthy tension in a capitalist economy. Low interest rates begin a recovery, fuel the expansion cycle, and as more demand for capital and inflation and bottlenecks emerge, interest rates rise, and this is that tension, sort of a healthy tension. A bit of a push and pull, which is part of the reason why many people, including some people who are advising Trump, want to see some of these things done on a rule basis rather than the ad hocery. How do we know what the Fed's going to do? Well, they tell us what they're going to do, but there's not a set rule like the Taylor rule. So the logic of the comprehensive program that Trump is offering, I think, lends itself more to rules-based of monetary policy to take it out of the hands of sort of a discretionary ad hoc basis. But I think that, you know, when I look around, I still come to the conclusion that I've shared with you before, and that is that if I look around and if we were playing poker, and I could have China's cards, I could have Europe's cards, I could have Japan's cards, I could have Russia's cards, I still think that the U.S. cards are still the best to play with right now.
Well, you certainly take a look at where interest rates are. You take a look at where economic growth is. We have some of the best economic growth in the developed world. As you look at all of this and you take a look at market valuations, one of the reasons why the stock market has done so well has had more to do with the expansion of PE multiples than it has been with earnings. Going forward, when do you think it is that earnings take over from PE multiples? Because right now, the stock market is selling at a little over 17 times forward earnings and 19 times trailing earnings, which are a bit on the expensive side. What's your view on, let's say, from a fundamental point of view, on market valuations?
Yeah, to tell you the truth, my own personal account, I'm a bit scared. I underperformed last year by being scared. My own personal account, I did about 4.5% return. And I know that the stock market was up 9%. And I think that I underperformed because I was cautious and scared about those valuations. Yet we've continued to go up, which means that I risk continuing to underperform. I'm impressed by the stock market strength. Middle of the week, the S&P 500 gapped higher. That is, we traded above Tuesday's range. And so far that gap remains unfilled. And to me, I would be advising people that we're watching that gap. It's about 2284 to about 2289. And as long as that gap is not filled in the S&P 500, it looks constructive to me. And I think that people still recognize that this bit of optimism, that corporate America is going to be stronger if Trump gets his way. And that is the tax reform, tax cuts, the deregulation, and the infrastructure spending, and this focus on building locally. I think his phrase is buy American and hire American. And I think that there's some big challenges with trade coming, but that this idea is very strong for the U.S. economy. I have a background in American history, and the closest period I can find to what we're going through right now is right after World War I. Wilson proposed forming the League of Nations. U.S. Senate says no. And this is the beginning of the American First movement. And the 1920s was featured deregulation, a number of tax reforms that eventually led to a large number of Americans not having to pay income tax. And of course, we know what happened in the 1920s, what it led to, a huge bubble, great disparity of wealth, huge bubble, and eventually the stock market pop and the Great Depression. And so what worries me is that these programs are good in the short run.
for the U.S. economy, that's what's lifting the stock market. We're looking on a quarterly basis or six-month basis. But the long run, we might be gutting killing the goose that lays the golden egg. For example, the financial crisis itself was perhaps partly a function of forgetting the lessons of our parents and our grandparents, like the importance of regulation, importance of Glass-Steagall. And now I wonder if we're not only forgetting those lessons again, but forgetting about the importance of prosperity. And prosperity in the U.S., I think the officials would argue, maybe perhaps not in the Trump administration, but prosperity and peace in the U.S. is inconceivable unless we have peace and prosperity in Europe and Asia. And I'd say the same thing about Mexico. I know Mexico has been under a lot of pressure. The Trump administration seeming to almost have an economic war with Mexico. But I think it's going to be very hard for the U.S., especially our southern states, to have prosperity and peace if we do not have a stable situation in Mexico. A destabilizing of Mexico could be very bad for the U.S.
So there's some negative side to some of these trade spats. Let's talk about these policies if implemented, because we know that, Mark, nothing gets done very quickly in Congress. A good example is already, even though it is widely expected that the president's cabinet members will get approved because of the dominance of the Republicans, and yet there are some delays. So if we talk about whether it's repealing Obamacare, whether it's getting rid of regulations, whether it's passing spending bills or passing tax cuts, all of that takes time. So is this a 2018 story rather than a 2017 story? In other words, by the time legislation works its way through, and even if they do cut taxes, we still don't know, depending on when the bill is passed, will they be retroactive to January 1st, or will they begin at the time the bill is passed, or will it begin in 2018? So are these stimulative things that the president's talking about doing, is it a 2018 story or is it a 2017 story?
And I think you raise a very important question. That is, even if we know the general policies of the new administration, we don't know the priorities and how long it's going to get to pass these programs through Congress. We've seen the president take new presidential actions as much as he can. I suspect that it's going to be more stretched out, more elongated, that perhaps now is not the best time to have a massive infrastructure spending, maybe a scaled-down version or maybe something that's phased in over time. Same thing with the deregulation. It's going to take some time to really have this full effect. So if I'm right about the comparison with the 1920s, this year, we're probably going to be, many people like myself are still going to be struggling to understand what the new president is saying and where he's going and to get a lot of these things through Congress. And without being distracted by like size of the inauguration attendance and the number of votes actually cast in the presidential election, these, I think, are distractions from the real underlying challenges our country faces. So I'm thinking that's going to take not just this year, but next year. And as you pointed out before, the Federal Reserve's dot plot say 3 hikes this year and 4 next year. That is, the pace of tightening increases as the economy continues to operate near full capacity. So I think it's going to take a couple of years to work this out. And the real test, I think, is forthcoming. I think the next big date I would have for your listeners probably would be the middle of March, when the U.S. debt ceiling is approached. And what does the administration do? The person who's been named for the Office of Management and Budget, the OMB, has talked about cutting Social Security and Medicare. And this would be a shock to many Americans who didn't expect this to happen. But so the first battle probably is over the size of the budget deficit. And what strikes me as just as an observer is that many people in Trump's cabinet, even though they haven't all been confirmed, they don't all agree with each other. And so from the outside, it seems difficult to know not only the priorities, but whose voice is going to carry the day. Sometimes you've got the formal organizational chart of whose call it is, but then there's an informal power structure. And it's not clear who's going to win out between those who are advocating, say, infrastructure spending, cutting taxes, and those who are concerned about the size of the deficit and the debt. So I think that this is why many of our clients at the banks are cautious and a high degree of uncertainty, which is why I think that we're seeing the stock market not rise so much on high volume. You know, a lot of people who are of that socioeconomic class that can begin, they're peaked on their 401k contributions, and beginning of the year, they can begin putting money into the stock market. Some of this money has to go to work with the mutual funds, but there's a lot of cash on the sidelines waiting for greater clarity and transparency, visibility, really, over what's going to be forthcoming.
So a lot of this has yet to be sorted out yet. So I know you mentioned last year, you were cautious. Do you still remain cautious? And is that the advice you would give investors at this moment?
Yeah, I am cautious. I think that even though I am constructive broadly on the U.S. economy, still growing around trend growth or so, I could see how there could be value in other countries' stock markets, like the Japanese stock market or the European stock markets. But I'm more cautious there in the sense that I like those stock markets, but I'm not so sure I like the currencies. So I still am favoring those ETFs, for example, that allow retail investors to buy foreign equity markets or sectors of foreign equity markets and hedge out the currency risk.
Well, Mark, as we close, you have a new book that is coming out. I wonder if we could spend a few moments and you can tell our listeners your new book, the subject matter you're covering, and the implications and the point of the book.
This new book is called Political Economy of Tomorrow. And what I do in this book is the first half of the book, I really re-examine post-World War II financial economic history from a particular perspective. And that perspective, I think, is not really known that much on Wall Street. I get the idea from a late 19th century advisor to a president, a guy named Charles Conant. And his understanding of capitalism is perhaps like similar to our understanding of some people we might know, where their greatest weakness grows out of their greatest strength. So he says capitalism is so wonderfully successful. It produces more goods and capital than we know what to do with. And their challenge is dealing with the surplus. And so I look at this post-World War II history through that perspective. And I say that this is the challenge for us, is what to do with all this capital, the surplus capital we have. So it might not feel like that on an individual level. One way of thinking about the surplus is thinking about the waste. Americans throw out about half the food we get. Half the food we grow, we throw away, or it's wasted. If I said that the price of oil is going up because there's more demand than supply, that's understandable. What about money? How can interest rates be so low if there's not too much capital? And so the first half looks at post-World War II history, focusing on the surplus of capital. The second half of the book is not so much about the economy per se, but it says because of these dramatic changes in the economy, trying to cope with the surplus, that relationships, social relationships have to change. And I look at three relationships. I look at men and women. I look at employee and employers. And I look at the state and citizens. And I'm not so much predicting the future. You know, there's a guy who writes a book called The Next 100 Years. I don't even know what I'm eating for dinner tonight, let alone what's going to happen in 100 years from now. But what I'm looking at is certain patterns. So I say there's been like a 2, 4, 6, and I'm guessing in terms of these relationships that are evolving, the next number is going to be 8. And so for me, it's a book that I've been working on for a long time. Some of these ideas have been germinating. Tell you the truth, I got kicked out of high school for organizing a student strike. And shortly thereafter, I've stumbled on some of these ideas, and I've been like sort of working on it and mulling this over for a long time, and I finally had an opportunity to present this. So Political Economy of Tomorrow is going to be coming out in a couple of weeks. The interesting thing here is my first book was published by Bloomberg Press. This book, I'm publishing it myself, and I still need a publisher's name, and my wife has always been very supportive and given me a long leash to explore these ideas, and so I named my publisher after her, called St. Janine Press.
Well, I'll look forward to seeing it, Mark. I can't wait to get my copy, and we'll have to talk to you about it once it comes out. And Mark, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so, please?
Quick way is I have a blog called Mark to Market. That's Mark with a C, marktomarket.com. I'm on Twitter as well. My handle there comes from the title of my first book. My Twitter handle is Mark Making Sense, after that first book called Making Sense of the Dollar. And any of your viewers who want to get on my distribution list for commentary that I email out, you can write to me at mark.chandler@bbh.com. That's Mark with a C, .chandler@boyboyharry.com.
Well, this is an era when we are told to expect the unexpected. But what exactly can we expect from expecting the unexpected? Coming up next on The Big Picture, we have a two-parter. In the first part, we will look at the emerging clash of titans, President Donald Trump versus Fed Chair Janet Yellen. They seem to be pushing in opposite directions. What is this going to mean for investment and for the market? And then part two, an interview with Charles Gav of GavCal Research discussing his new book and concerns about what lies ahead in this era of unexpected expectations. All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense NewsHour continues at financialsense.com.